Words you will hear on the program today: debt and limit, shadow and banking, G and seven. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday today. This one, I believe, is the 15th of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Regular listeners to this program will have heard me say more than a couple of times that running the federal government is not, repeat, not like running a business. We can go into specifics another time if you'd like, but I'm just going to ask you to trust me on this one for now. All of that said, there are some basic similarities, and one of them is cash flow. Money coming in, money going out. So far this year, says the Congressional Budget Office, the Internal Revenue Service has collected about $2.7 trillion, about $250 billion short of what it was guessing it would bring in just a couple of months ago. And before you say, great, fine, Kai, whatever, that's interesting, but why are you talking to me about tax receipt forecasts? Might I remind you of this week's debt limit negotiations? Marketplace's Savannah Marr starts us off.
Economists were expecting a drop in tax revenue after last year's boom, but not a 26% drop. So why were the forecasts so off?
Full disclosure, we don't really know.
Caroline Bruckner, a tax expert at American University, says the Congressional Budget Office is probably waiting for more data before it names a culprit. But if she had to guess,
it could be that there were fewer capital gains transactions.
Early in the pandemic, sales of homes and stocks and other taxable assets were soaring, and so were capital gains receipts.
In the first 7 months of fiscal year 2023, people weren't buying as much stuff.
Plus, the IRS gave a lot of American taxpayers an extension this year, including almost everyone in the most populous state, says Bernard Yaros with Moody's.
Because most Californians reside in federally declared disaster areas due to recent flooding, mudslides, and winter storms.
There's a climate angle to everything. And shrinking revenues are especially problematic right now, says Alex Arnon with the Penn Wharton budget model.
We are relying on what comes in every day to finance what has to go out every day.
Lawmakers thought they had until late summer to work out a deal before the government ran out of cash. In part thanks to this surprise tax revenue shortfall, the debt ceiling crunch is here now. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
So, repeat after me, running the federal government is not like running a business. Case in point, and again, it's a cash flow thing, clawing back money the government has appropriated but hasn't spent yet, specifically pandemic relief funds. One possible, emphasis here on the word possible, area of agreement as those debt limit talks go on, is a Republican demand to take that money back. President Biden has said the idea is, quote, on the table. Thing is, there is not a whole lot of unspent money left. Marketplace's Henry Epp went looking to see how much might still be out there.
Congress passed six big spending bills in response to COVID, totaling $4.6 trillion, according to the Government Accountability Office. And the GAO's Kristen Kosolek says most of that money is gone.
By far, the vast majority of the funds have been obligated. There are these amounts that are left.
The exact amount left is not totally clear. It was about $90 billion the last time GAO made an estimate at the end of January. Now it could be as little as $30 billion, says Bill Hoagland, a senior vice president with the Bipartisan Policy Center.
If you could call that back, it's a nice hunk of change, so to speak, but it is, in the grand scheme of things, it's a small piece of the negotiations.
And it would be a tiny part of this year's federal deficit of over $900 billion. Still, $30 billion isn't nothing. Among other things, it's supposed to go towards modernizing outdated unemployment insurance systems and providing health services to tribal communities. But it's not clear that all of the unobligated funds can be clawed back, says Marielle Lopez-Santana, an associate professor of policy and government at George Mason University.
I think it's going to be very difficult to do this, right? Because we're talking about, you know, hundreds of agencies.
Not to mention all the states, municipalities, and tribes that might be expecting this money. I'm Henry Epp for Marketplace.
Equities on this Monday, debt limit fears such as they ever existed, which was, TBH, not very much, do seem to have dissipated a bit. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We've been talking for weeks now, months, I think, actually, about how all the agita in regional banking and the year plus of interest rate increases by the Federal Reserve have led to tighter credit. Loans are harder to get. Money's more expensive. Things are just tighter. And while banks are pulling back a bit, there is opportunity here, too, specifically what are called shadow banks to step in and fill the business loan void. Lauren Hirsch wrote about it for the New York Times the other day. Lauren, it's good to have you on again.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, we got to define some terms here. Shadow banks, please.
Shadow banks is actually a bit of a controversial term. Because I got some feedback on my original article. The IMF defines it as basically any financial institution that doesn't take deposits but loans. So that can be money market funds, that can be hedge funds, that can be private equity firms. And the big kind of distinguishing factor between your Apollos of the world and your JP Morgan is Apollo doesn't take deposits. So it doesn't have kind of everyday customers giving you your cash and leaving it there.
Does it tell you anything that the shadow banks don't like to be called shadow banks?
It tells you a lot. They hate it. They view it as a PR problem, but many people just view it as kind of, you know, a definition of what they are, you know, for better or for worse.
Fair enough. But anyway, the reason we got you on the phone is because These shadow banks, to be clear, are playing an ever-increasing role in lending in this economy. And I want you to tell me how that's come to pass.
So it's really been almost a decade-long trend. You know, after the financial crisis, the government put in a lot of regulations on the biggest banks. That was all a part of Dodd-Frank. I think many people would argue at this point, most of those regulations were a good idea. But what happens is when there's more regulations, the cost of capital goes up and it becomes more complicated to extend loans. And so money in a lot of the lending business ended up leaving the regulated banks and it ended up going to the Apollos, Blackstones of the world because they could effectively move much faster and extending loans and, you know, occasionally even do loans that your traditional very large regulated bank might not be able to do.
Talk to me then about the risk involved here, because banks are regulated for a reason. And if shadow banks aren't regulated, but are increasing their share of the loan business in this economy, where are we?
Well, that's the $1 million, potentially $1 billion question. Right. The biggest concern, if you chat with industry advocates or academics, is you have a huge portion of the economy moving over to these unregulated institutions. And not only are they not kind of privy to the same requirements as your large banks, but you just, by definition, have less information about them. Mm-hmm. And so it's almost impossible for us to have full clarity and insight as to, you know, whether or not there are mistakes that have been made. Mm-hmm. Now, if you talk to the industry, they say a couple of things. First, because they aren't a bank without deposits, if they do make a mistake, the only one that is harmed in their views is their own investors. So that's their defense. I think who wins out in the risk analysis is still yet to be seen.
It's incumbent on me to point out here that, as you mentioned, the rise in this kind of lending has taken place over the last decade or so. The last decade or so was a time of extraordinarily low interest rates with, until relatively recently, not a great likelihood of recession. And it's just different now.
It's just different now. And so we are in this rate experiment. We have this industry that has built up over the past 10 years. It's poised to become even bigger, frankly, as, you know, the regional banks fall, the larger banks are kind of constrained. And it's just a totally untested model. The one thing that everyone's been saying over the past 6 months to me is it's really easy to make money when everyone is making money. You know, when interest rates are low. And this is an entirely different environment. I covered the bankruptcy of Vice this morning. There were a couple other bankruptcies that happened, and there's more to come. You know, we're seeing defaults. And so the big question will be, are these systems and these loans that they've put out, you know, can they effectively withstand it.
Well, yeah. And to that end, and real quick on the way out here, the Treasury Secretary, Janet Yellen, has said she wants to bring shadow banks under a more regulatory strict sort of paradigm. Do you anticipate that actually happening?
She has said that. You will hear noise every now and then. I will tell you, when I talk to people kind of behind the scenes, I do get the sense it's maybe fourth or fifth on their priority list. It's not one or two. You know, they've been effectively been putting out a fire with the regional bank crisis. You know, and there's obviously debt ceiling drama going on right now. And so it does seem like something that tends to go to the bottom of list priorities until or unless there's a real problem to address.
Right. Lauren Hirsch at The New York Times. Thanks, Lauren. Good to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
If you're looking to fly this summer and maybe haven't booked your tickets yet, here's the thing. Google's got a new feature it's rolling out on Google Flights where, depending on the actual flight, it'll keep monitoring the price after you book. And if the price drops, Google will pay you the difference automatically and for free. Other sites do offer their own versions of price guarantees. Yes, true. Not for free, though. But let's talk business model here for a second, shall we? Why do this and how remunerative is it anyway? Marketplace's Samantha Fields has that one.
My process for booking flights usually goes something like this. Check Kayak, check Google, check different airline websites, and get increasingly stressed and cranky, wondering if I'll find something cheaper if I wait.
The vast majority of the time, that isn't going to happen.
Mike Arnott at the airline analytics company Cirium says that's assuming I'm looking for tickets less than 3 months before I want to travel. That's when most people book, he says, and airlines know this. So that's also when ticket prices tend to start going up.
If I had to tell my mom when she should book a flight to get the best fare on offer, I would say 3 to 4 months out, you're likely to get those lowest fares that are available, and they're not likely to magically reappear.
This is not a hard and fast rule. It does vary by route and airline and whether you're flying economy or business class. Airlines have a ton of data they use to constantly adjust fares and maximize revenue for different routes, and they aren't sharing it.
The closest that we have as consumers are the online travel agencies, the Kayaks and the Hoppers of the world, and the big behemoth, which is Google Flights.
These sites also have years of data on booking and flight prices, more actually than any one airline. At the travel app Hopper, lead economist Haley Berg says they've been tracking global airfare prices for more than 10 years.
Our archive is up to, I think at last measurement, maybe 80 or 85 trillion priced itineraries.
That's trillion with a T. And she says they use those trillions of past flight itineraries and prices to train their algorithm.
And we take all of that data and a very complex price prediction and boil it down into something very simple and user-friendly, which is a recommendation.
Book now or wait. Those recommendations, she says, are accurate about 95% of the time. Still, somehow, that doesn't really lessen my anxiety around booking flights. And talking to Jade Kessler at Google Flights, it sounds like it's not just me.
One of the things that we often hear from people is that they really want to know if they're getting a good deal or not on their airfare.
She says that's a big reason why Google is piloting this new free price drop guarantee on certain flights with certain airlines. If you book on Google,
then we monitor the price every day until takeoff, and we automatically pay you back the difference if there's a price drop.
Other sites do different versions of this. At Hopper and certain airlines, for example, you can freeze the price of a flight for a little while, but you have to pay for it, kind of like buying insurance. Mike Arnott at Cirium says it's pretty low stakes for Google to offer this price drop guarantee for free because
they make their money when you do a search and you click on an ad. And they make so much money that the risk to Google of having to pay out to a passenger is really a drop in the bucket.
In a way, it wouldn't be for other companies like Hopper, Kayak, or Expedia that make money by taking a cut of bookings people make through their sites. Plus, right now, Google is only offering the guarantee on a limited basis. So limited, in fact, that I found it hard to find a flight that had it at all. I did eventually, on some Spirit flights from New York to Miami, that were already so cheap I wouldn't need a guarantee to buy. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we still anticipate operating at a negative deficit.
Well, that can't be good. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 47 points on this Monday, a 10th percent, 33,348. The NASDAQ up 80 points, 80 points, 0.2%, closed at 12,365. The S&P 500 added 12, about 0.3%, 41.36. Brokerage firm Charles Schwab moved up 4% after an upgrade from Raymond James. Raymond James said worries about bank stability in the United States have not weakened Schwab's ability to draw in new accounts and thus assets. Fidelity grew a 10%. Robinhood gave back about 1%. Shake Shack beefed up 7.8%. Today, the Wall Street Journal reported that the activist investor Engaged Capital, which owns about a 6.6% share in that fast food chain, has its sights on 3 board seats at the company. I don't know if it comes with fries or not. White House and Congress resume negotiations on the nation's debt ceiling tomorrow. Told you about that. Deadline just a couple of weeks away. Meanwhile, total consumer debt in this economy, a new record in the first quarter of this year. That's according to new figures from the New York Federal Reserve. Borrowing exceeded $17 trillion for the first time. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.50%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Assuming, I suppose, that those debt limit talks make acceptable progress, President Biden scheduled to be in Japan at the end of the week for the G7, where economic coercion may well wind up being the phrase of the week. It's a key complaint of the G7 and its allies about how China is reacting to countries that cross it. Marketplace's Lily Jamali explains what's going on there.
There's a long list of commodities that have been subject to this so-called economic coercion, says Matthew Reynolds of the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
Salmon in Norway, bananas in the Philippines, canola in Canada, Shiraz.
China's halt on these direct imports can last a few years, sometimes less, but while they're in place,
they are costly to the sectors and the firms that are targeted.
Reynolds says one solution could be a compensation fund led by the U.S. for those firms and their home countries. China, for its part, dismisses the idea that the way it does business is a problem and has pointed to the way other G7 countries use economic and military coercion. Susan Thornton is with Yale Law's Paul Tsai China Center.
The Chinese see this as unfriendly action, part of the U.S. containment strategy.
But Thornton says the G7 simply stating its support to affected countries and their business interests might be enough of a signal. Gennady Goldberg is a U.S. rate strategist at TD Securities.
If I am a manufacturer and I have deep exposure to China, it would certainly make me think twice about investing in additional capacity.
But whatever the final document or communique that follows the G7 looks like, David Dollar, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution's China Center, says don't expect China to be called out by name.
You've got dissent within the G7 about how to deal with China.
And he says that's going to limit what they're willing to say. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
At the height of the pandemic, state and federal governments gave rural hospitals hundreds of billions of dollars in aid, both to help with staffing and to help handle increased patient loads. That aid, for the most part, has dried up, and those hospitals are now seeing fewer patients. And now, in some states, especially Texas and others that haven't expanded Medicaid, there is a real risk of hospital closures. A new federal lifeline, though, is offering millions of dollars to help keep their emergency rooms open. Marketplace's Elizabeth Trovall went out to East Texas to do some reporting.
So this is our ER. This is our nurse's
Ashley
station.
Ashley London walks me through St. Luke's Memorial Hospital in San Augustine, Texas, a town of about 2,000 people. She explains what the hospital can do.
We have an OB room, so if we had a mom coming in who was pregnant, having some kind of difficulty, that's where we could do a delivery.
And what the hospital can't do anymore, that is.
So this is our psych observation room. But because of our change in staffing, that's not a patient that we can keep here because I can't afford to have one nurse tied up with one patient with one-on-one observation.
London is in charge of patient services here at the small single-story red brick hospital. It's hard work, doing more with less to provide the best medical care possible to this remote area, roughly 20 miles from the Louisiana border. Lately, they just haven't seen many patients, just one a day on average, forcing them to eliminate inpatient services and jobs.
We lost a total of 17 in the facility.
Nearly a third of its staff. London tears up when we discuss layoffs, but she understands the cuts are necessary so the hospital can keep its doors open for emergencies and some outpatient services like radiology and physical therapy. While patient volume has been down, costs are up. Monty Bostwick is president of St. Luke's East Texas Hospitals.
And when you're already operating at a deficit, if you see your operating expenses going up, but there's no more money coming in, then let's see what else we can do.
What they did was take advantage of a new pot of government money, specifically for rural emergency hospitals. The hospital in San Augustine was already getting government cash through a program that required them to have inpatient beds. The new program allows them to eliminate inpatient care and keep their funding. But Bostwick says it won't be enough.
We still anticipate operating at a negative deficit.
Bostwick and others are trying to avoid the fate of the 76 rural hospitals that have closed nationwide since 2010, which is especially important to this community's aging population, including longtime resident Wesley Hoyt, who has relied on this hospital since he was in high school in the 1960s.
I had an accident up here at a field house where one of those huge circular fans struck me in the head. They brought me here to this hospital.
Just a few years back, Hoyt had another crisis.
When I started getting dressed, I noticed that my left side suddenly, it just went numb.
He got a ride to the hospital.
10-15 minutes, they had run me into a CT scan.
Because of the scan, they were able to give him a treatment to minimize the effects of the stroke. They gave it to him before he was flown to the Veterans Hospital in Houston. He says without that treatment, he might have ended up paralyzed.
Had it not been for the quick-thinking women up here at this hospital, I mean, they literally saved my life.
One of the quick-thinking women behind the San Augustine emergency room is Penny Russell, a battle-tested nurse practitioner.
It is stressful in the middle of the night when there's four people in the whole hospital, and your lab radiology tech is trying to perform their job, and you have five or seven patients.
It's on her to handle whatever comes through the door, an emergency tracheotomy, delivering a 27-week-old preemie, the aftermath of an oil rig explosion or wood chip mill accident.
I have had those patients that you can't get them out of here, and there's nothing you can do, and you accept that you do the best you can do, and you pray a lot.
With a bare-bones staff, it's on her and her colleagues to be prepared for anything. I'm Elizabeth Troval for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which we paraphrase the concept with which we started, ways in which the federal government is not like a business. The debt limit's not like a family credit card either, no matter how many times you hear that. But I mention it because data out from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York today shows that for the first time in 20 years, household credit card debt did not decline in the first quarter. Usually what happens is we spend our ways through the holidays and pay it down January through March. Not this year, though. Possibly a sign that we're all leaning on plastic to keep up all that spending we are doing. All right, we got to go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. Just to really round out the inadvertent theme of the program today, the debt limit and problems therewith. Janet Yellen, Secretary of the Treasury, doubled down on her best estimate for a possible X date in a new letter to congressional leaders today. June 1, it is 17 days, if you're counting, which we are. Our daily production team includes Livy Burdett, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Nicholas Giong, Maria Hollenhorst, Sarah Leeson, and Sean McHenry. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow. This is APM.